Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books Network for South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Preeti Ramaprasad, and today I'm so excited to talk to Dr. Suraj Yengde about his new book, Caste Matters, which was published last year by Penguin Random House, India. Suraj Yengde is currently a senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School and is an inaugural postdoctoral fellow at the Harvard Initiative for Institutional Anti-Racism and Accountability. He's also India's first Dalit PhD holder from an African university. Suraj is a published author in the field of caste, race, ethnicity studies, and interregional labor migration in the Global South. Currently, he's involved in developing a critical theory of Dalit and Black studies. Suraj also holds a research position with the Department of African and African American Studies and is a non-resident fellow at the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research. Finally, he's also a convener of the Dalit Film Festival and the Dalit Literature Festival. Suraj, thank you so much for being with me today.
Absolute pleasure, Preeti. Thank you so much for reaching out and for your attention to my work. As I was telling you, I was a little bit weary of giving my time to podcasts, but now I'm excited. So let's begin.
Great. So Suraj, I wonder if you can tell us about yourself. I mean, that's such an essential part of this text and also your methodology, right? Also your family history. It informs such a great part of this text, and it's so compelling and it's just so beautifully written and elaborated upon. So I wonder if you could kind of, give a little bit of a teaser about that for this audience.
Sure. Thank you so much for asking that question. More especially on the methodological aspects of this, because much of the text that is written was written initially in a humanistic tradition. I was highly, highly inspired by the Greek-Roman tradition of humanist thought, but also I was inspired by the Africanist as well as the Indian humanist thought, because that's how I found obvious comfort and place into. And also the issues that I deal with, that I live with, that I fight for, are so complex and so deep-rooted in recovering and reclaiming our humanity that I had to rely on the archives of the existent humanists. And that's why when I wrote this text was having an orientation into that, and it still is. You can see there is a lot of inspirations one can draw, one can infer, or delineate through this text. The major part of my story was not meant to be part of this book in its original form.
Oh, really?
And And, this is probably many authors who are listening to this podcast might concur that, your ideas get distilled and, changed and ameliorated so many times that what is yours doesn't really remain yours. It in fact gets more fashioned, and it's also the business of publishing, because it's not only about selling, but it's also how people conceive ideas, and that was one of the high calls. When I had sent this proposal to the to my, I mean, I've already worked with Penguin before, so they knew I was up to something. They were simply like, you've written very difficult for us to understand. Can you just say it simply? And then I wrote simply, and then they say, still, can you say it in more simple terms? And, you know, as an academic trained in, you know, these many various traditions, I just was a little bit irked by this reaction. And then finally, you know, they had to come to terms with, you know, why don't you, you know, they say, okay, let's sign a contract first because you have a project here. So they immediately, you know, they wanted me to get on board, and I just had sent them one page, and on that page they had signed a contract. And once I sent the book is when, you know, the real process begins. And so my personal story, I was never willing to trade. I never even thought about it as a, you know, as a worthy project that I know. And also it's the position of the victim, of the oppressed, who is constantly told you are marketing your own experiences to get one foot inside the door. And as if you come from an oppressed community, you are so you're so trained to not fall into the prejudicial, stereotypical epithets that people hold on or hold against you. And so that's why I never wanted my story to become a point of anchor. I just wanted my quote unquote intellectual inquiry be the shining light of that space. But you know, it took me at least three iterations to come to terms with my lovely editor, Richa Berman. You know, she really pushed me hard, and of course the associate publisher then, Ranjana Sen Gupta, was also, you know, insistent that I do something that this book is coming to. But I was not convinced. And so at Harvard, my colleagues, more especially Nico Miele, my director, probably he's the only guy who read this book in its two different versions. So when he read the first version, he just came out with a bunch of comments, and, you know, he was saying similar to what my editors were saying, and I had not shared this information with him. So I just wanted to, you know, because they would gag up. And of course, you know, Devin Maharaj, the former LA Times editor-in-chief, who was a fellow then, he read through and, you know, he kind of gave me an idea of how to disclose information. Now, you have to understand, these people are coming from different vantage points. These people are not, in your traditional sense, social science academics. You know, these are people who are doing a career in journalism or career in nonfiction writing. And also the concerns I bring to the table were important, and the obvious question was, if I jargonize it, if I locate it into a certain philosophical tradition, would the wider mass be able to appreciate what you have written? And the question then remained, do you want to write books for library shelves, or do you want to write book for people? And for me, I didn't care either. I just wanted to write because I wanted to write. I didn't want the book to, you know, I did not care about the career of the book, you know, and I come from a, you know, kind of this thought where if you are bright enough, you will shine. And then that's how it had its own value to begin with. And so the methodology kind of then, you know, over the period of time, it kind of, and so much of that book was then, you know, I writing it in the last 2 years of the publishing of the book, you know, kind of lot of revisions, lot of writings. And that's how the methodology, and personally, I liked it in the sense that I was able to experiment and innovate with newer methodologies. And also I didn't want to write a text that will be like a paragon, that will be a citation for next generation scholars. I wanted them to feel free because I'm also trained. My advisor for my PhD, Dilip Menon, was the guy who in fact liberated me from the Euro-American centric paradigms of intellectual projects. He just, you know, he just rescued me. And so that, in a way, I wanted to then, you know, pursue something which is accessible, which is knowledgeable, which is informative, and also which is action oriented. And one could do it very ways. I am glad I could keep my academic tempo alive. The rigor was still there. The reviewers had their own queries and suggestions, as every reviewer should have. And also, I could satisfy my publisher, or rather my editor, who wanted this for people to pick up and remember what they read, and not just, you know. Also, it's about, you know, how effective you write. Doesn't mean you always need to describe a story. But, you know, for example, when Franz Fanon talks about experiences of blackness, he mentions some stories also of Martinique. And, of course, after reading all of that corpus of literature, I still remember some of the stories, anecdotes he shared, which certainly had more, you know, values. So I guess for me, it's a newer form of writing experiment that I did, and I like experimenting with new pioneering ideas.
Right. That's interesting that you were kind of hesitant about it in the beginning, because I think one of the that is one of the aspects of the text that is so you know, explosive, right? That it pairs this theory with it's such well written experiences that that really inform how you lay out your theory. And there's a lot of discussion often about the notion of authenticity, right? And I think authenticity is, I find more and more, is best delivered as, you know, an experience that is really felt. And I really see that very clearly in this text. So
thank you.
So I just want to talk about one of my questions is, In as you delve into your first chapter, you talk about when you travel. Speaking of anecdotes, as you travel abroad to study, you made friends, and there's this notion of transnationality in politics, right? And you talk about how your friends engage with you as it came to Dalit politics. Can you discuss a little bit of that and how you delve into it further in your text, and how that kind of informed how you would commit to this research and this text later on?
That's a very good question, and I like it because you know, the commitment to the text is what also matters, right? Because you know, I've seen many scholars, you know, who write books. And they write the books. And for me, it's like, once you finish the book, they move on to the next project. And that inspires me too. You know, it's like, because there is so much you have to do in your life. But when you say a commitment to a text, that really means that's a magnum opus. You know, that's a literature, that's a text that's going to inspire, that's going to change, and hopefully help us humanize our sensibilities. And in that sense, I welcome that question and also that approach. You see, when I wrote this text, I was also very particular on what scholars to cite and what scholars to ignore. You know, and I didn't do it intentionally. It just came to me naturally that some of the caste concept that I'm describing, it is unsurprising, or rather surprising, whichever way one can look at it, that there are not many Euro-American interpretations of Dalit question here, or even the Brahmin or dominant caste interpretation of, you know. And I think that's probably one of the beauty of that book, is it doesn't really essentialize on writing into certain disciplinary modes. I wanted to, and this is what I told my editor, my publisher, in fact, that I want to write a book that will break the backs of disciplinary hierarchies, because my experience cannot be confined to one disciplinary orientation. You know, it cannot be anthropologized, it cannot be socialized, it definitely cannot be interpreted only in cultural or literary studies. There has to be a multiverse, a variance that change as we change the topic, as we change the view, the perspective, as well as the aspiration. And these are all dynamics that cannot literally be explored in one ivory tower. It needs to change its loyalties. It needs to change its faith-based ascriptions. It needs more house than one house. It just needs a larger space. And that's why sky and earth is the larger canvas. That's why universality is so central to me. And to think about this is to actually locate in transnationality. And transnationality doesn't come as an equation. It just comes as a normalized response. I didn't have to invest. I didn't have to think hard. I even didn't have to work through the available stories, if you will. It was just an occurrence. It's almost like a mathematical formation. 1 + 1 = 2.
Right.
You know, so, and this is what the uniqueness of this project, but also the Dalit community as a whole is. When you engage with the political as well as social praxis of Dalit livelihood, I call the life worlds, what we see in this context is the other totemic rationalities that give rise to multiple universalities. And that's why the Dalit universalism sits at that very occasion on the axis to promote a thought of beyond one's limitation, because being a Dalit is to be limited, is to be confined, is to be cordoned.
Right.
But then when you assert your identity, you do everything that is held against you. You don't confine. You don't aspire in limited vocations. You actually think outside. You think beyond. Because what does the oppressed person think beyond the shackles? Because that's what they always aspire to. Whereas the oppressor will always only think about those squares that he or she or they have put us into. Because that's the world they want to live in. Whereas the oppressed doesn't want to leave. Us oppressed wants to break that and think about what's available in the rest of the world. And that's why you will also notice the early indenture migration, Dalits volunteered to go and become indentured because they wanted to explore the world. Also, they want to get rid of the squared or the feudal plantation sites owned by the dominant caste in the native country in India.
Right.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I was going to ask something else, but since you brought it up, you in one of your chapters, you bring up the sheer multiplicity, right, of Dalit identity. And that informed such a large portion of your text, right? And you delve into not just, oh, this exists, but the various characteristics of, you know, these multiple characters, and also like how that informs their worldview, how that informs how they act, right? And how they, mm-hmm. how that informs how they interact with their own Dalit community, right? And so how do you factor feminism in there? Because it is like intrinsically located in the theory there. And I just would love to hear you discuss how it factors in there.
I'm so glad you could find the remnants of that in that. That was the purpose as well. You know, the feminine, even before we become the feminist, the feminine aspect of caste is the originality of caste system. Because the suppression of a bodily fluid, the control on desire and sexuality is the definition of caste system. And when we try to locate the femininity and eventually the feminist argument against the caste, the femininity has to be the leading item that could attack, or rather tool, if you will, in the words of Audre Lorde, that would definitely dismantle the oppressor. Exactly. I didn't want to use master simply because we are living in a new time where, I'd rather never call, you know. But in this context, Preeti, the Dalit project is actually a feminist project. And when I say feminist project, I don't want to genderize, because of course gender also is a problematic term.
Yes.
There is an entirety of how one locates one's femininity in establishing an anti-caste critique. And the Dalit leaders, who were obviously the one we know are mostly male, but also there are significant females. But the gender identity for Dalit male was not necessarily the male that we usually identify with or identified. The Dalit male is a character that is very much rooted in the anti-caste feminist thinking. And this Dalit male character, that's why aspires to become the Dalit feminine object an object of interpretation, where then they would use the same canon to dismantle the caste system. Because if you have to destroy a caste system, you have no option but destroy the patriarchy and the sensibilities that it brings with it. It be homophobia, transphobia, and other forms of sexuality-based phobias that is trying to heteronormatize the fundamental ethic of caste system, which is basically to have a reproduction-based mechanism. And right. it is in this logic, my book actually starts with the woman in my life.
Yeah, exactly.
And any reader who would read will follow the chart of thoughts, right? Once I have placed that, that's a hint for you to read the rest of the text. Be it my grandma, be it my mother, these are the people who fantastically lay the ideological grooming for the next heavy-handed thoughts that I bring to the table. One should never lose the focus when I talk about grand ideas, that these ideas originate from the nucleus where I draw my legitimacy from.
Right. That was so apparent how you kind of set the scene with that. And now my favorite question and my favorite part of the text by far was your discussion of love, right? It just informed such a great part of your text. You talk a lot about love and specifically Dalit love, which I think, you know, this idea of radical love as a juxtaposition. Can you just elaborate upon that a bit?
I mean, there is a possibility of juxtapositioning, and the positioning is often voluntary. You know, one can position, but I have to think about the conditions that give rise to the original, and the original could be anything: idea, human, perspective, whatnot. And that's why I chart out the juxtaconditions where Dalits live in two polar axioms. One is possibilities. There are endless possibilities and possibilities of anything, possibilities of many things. And it's just an unseen. It's just the worship of the Almighty. It's just the faith in something that would happen, something good would happen. My mother lived as a, you know, below poverty line in India. And all she could do was have a faith in the possibility of the unseen, of what's going to happen next. She didn't know her child is going to get to Harvard, going to get, you know, degrees. And, you know, she just had that faith in the possibility. She didn't know what that possibilities will look like. But that sheer courage to have a possibility as something you can own is profound. One has to really realize these are the people who were two generations ago slaves, who were about a generation ago illegitimately put under the cordons of caste system in their villages. Within a generation, these people are endlessly thinking about the cosmic possibilities of what is possible. And it's not only material, but it's also spiritual. And spiritualism is then a condition to their philosophical development of how they then inherit those qualities into their children. And so I basically am the carrier of that thought for so many generations that my ancestor thought. That is a possibility, one. But the second is there is a deep pain as well. Dalits undergo traumas, atrocities. They go repeated memories of pain. Facilities that the casteist order has provided them to remind them of their pain. One can have an ankle broken, and you might forget about it if you can forget, and you will not remember about that pain. But for us, every direction we turn, we are reminded of our pain. And so that pain is just not a pain on surface, but that pain is deep rooted. It's inside your heart, it's inside your body. It operates like the blood flowing through your vein. And that's why the idea of this deep pain is also a movement of possibilities. Because through that pain, what you see is you generate a response, which then creates a belief where you have to now solve this with the idea of love. Because loving the unloved is what Dalit community has taught the world. You love the already loved one. Parents loving their children is a love that you will love. Parents or siblings loving each other is a love. But how about loving someone who has been unloved? And that unloved could be anybody. And that unloved is what we created. It is not that the person is physically or mentally unlovable. We have made that person, that condition, an unloved situation. And I think that's why what we think, what I argue in this, is the unloved belongs to an underappreciated and unrecognized segment. Right. Who is deriving the suffering of humanity. That's a big thing. We are representing the suffering of humanity as a whole. And it is in this pursuit we hope to guide and hold on to our ancestral values of how to love. And that's why I say it is the possibility of Dalit love, as I describe it, it creates the belief on how to survive. The recipe of resilience for the Dalit community, because you all should know, Dalits are the oldest survivors known to this earth. We have been kept untouchables. Caste system has changed. It has taken its various forms. But the condition of untouchables didn't matter to anybody, whoever, whatever religious tradition they came from, because as much as it hoped to offer a hope to this, there were many traditions who were eventually co-opted, and yet we were sent back right to our position. So we remain the oldest surviving discriminated community, and yet manage to think high of the world and think about the possibilities. And I think it is here where I talk about how then we live a model of living a life, which is to create and recreate the animating aspect of belief in each other through the principle of love.
Yeah, I thought that was profound. That's all I'm going to say about that, because people should read how you elaborate on it. You also discuss humor as a subversive, as a means of subversive, particularly with reference to the Brahmin, right? Mm-hmm. And you talk about kind of colloquialisms, and you kind of translate some of them. Can you elaborate? Can you just like elaborate upon that a little bit and discuss how the Brahmin is referenced in that regard?
Brahmin is a joke for us.
Yeah.
It's a butt of pittance. We, in fact, whenever we grew up, our jokes were centralizing the Brahmin as a foolish subject, as someone stupid, senile, someone who doesn't really, can't think beyond his pot-bellied figurine and the thread he's trying to sport to gain more space. You know, that was for us ridiculous. Like, you can't really, you know, and a Brahmin was an ugly figure because that's how we saw also, you know. And that's why our jokes were also surrounded around a character which was then this Brahmin, this mythical Brahmin, or sometimes it would also be a Baniya, the shopkeeper who is trying to con us and, you know, trying to exploit us by his treacherous, trading policies. So these were like the characters that always we made fun of. We made fun of their thread. We say that thread is it turns dark when they wear it. It doesn't take a week for it to turn to a different color. That's how much the thread is also tired of this stinking body that is reeking hatred for us. So the fight, at least on an intellectual level, was not always the Brahmins controlling the narrative. We also had our own narratives. It's just that it was never humanized. Mm. It was never theorized. It was never given an attention. And so humor is one way where we actually laugh at other, but also laugh with others. You know, and that's a very fundamental difference of how we elate a certain egoistic, pleasures. But then, you know, we know also. So one of the things is, if you go in Dalit community, you will see humor has a premium. The right. Dalits know how to laugh. Just spend some time with them. They will find all kinds of reasons, all kinds of jocular expressions, all kinds of small things. Sometimes it's mimicry, or sometimes it's just on some citational references or running something, because they just know how to, and they laugh loud. They laugh for the world. So when they're laughing, the world knows that someone is celebrating or someone is having that moment of that the thing can be celebrated and can be relaxed for that while. And I think in this humorous capacity, I definitely, kind of, there are various ways of how do we have comedic values attached to a human survival. Because if we forget to laugh, we also forget to cry. And crying and laughing are one of the most important values that we can live up to. Because many times we forget to cry or we forget to laugh. And I think that has to do with the depressive state of the condition of the person who is put into that. However, for Dalits, for us, this is a beautifying value. This is a kind of crown that we carry very proudly on each other. If we know how to cry, you also know, we know how to laugh as well. And you damn will know when we laugh. And so our jokes are, for example, if anybody farted, as kids. And so, as a group, if anybody farted, so we would be like, who is the culprit, right? But not the culprit. Who's the Brahmin culprit? Mm. That was how we identified, because we saw Brahmins eating all the peas and the undigestive snacks because their vegetarian habitual palate would not invite them to eat some healthy protein of beef and other flesh, which then, of course, then obviously the Brahmin farts, and we all saw also. Yes, and so that's why when we identified a Brahmin with a stinky Brahmin or a Brahmin who really is a Brahmin who really smells bad, because we saw that as well. And I think that was one of the way we countered. That was our protest. That was our challenge to the mighty prowess of a Brahmin hegemony that we have amidst us. And this is, by the way, available in almost every other Dalit bastis where we have such kind of interlocutions of our own, expressions of jokes. One very essential aspect of this is, it was a liberating exercise. Mm. It was elevating everybody's agency in that laughter. So when we laughed at, we wanted us to be liberated for that moment. We wanted us to feel high. We wanted us to be in the skies and in the moments where we lose ourselves for even that moment. You know, just think about yourself. The last time you laughed out hard, you the thoughts were not there. I mean, once you got into that moment of extreme laughter for that microsecond or few seconds, you were in a different state of mind. And I think that is the kind of reserve that we would like to, you know, maintain and present to us. And that's why many vernacular jokes are also, you know, around how we have humor. But unfortunately, that Dalit humor is not appreciated. People don't know about that. People don't even, you know, dare to think about that. And I guess I had to write about this in a form that people, you know, could at least understand. Once I wrote this, you know, many people from other regions, Telugu, Kannada, they wrote to me and say, you know what, we also have similar in our languages as well. So there is a lot. We would like to create a Dalit humor dictionary.
Ah, I'd like to see that. I think that's interesting. Like also who has access to this notion of theory, who has visibility, right? Even though this idea of humor exists in other places, where is it visible? And you made this one shade, this one aspect very visible. And I think it also has to do with the precarity of human life also. One of the things that you describe a lot is the view of that people have of Ambedkar, right? And I think Ambedkar's philosophy informs a lot of people's, you know, how they view casteism in India and policy also, right? How do you kind of interrogate how people view Ambedkar in your book? How do you interrogate how they analyze Ambedkar?
I mean, you know, Ambedkar is now become almost in the past few years, one can count, has become a star intellectual for the world.
Right.
But for us, he has always been, right? It's the discovery of the elite class who wants to now reclaim Ambedkar, who wants to now, you know, hold on to Ambedkar, because everything else has been almost become futile. Every other political leader that you have right now, the nation celebrates. People don't celebrate. You know, nation celebrating is basically the state sponsoring that. And, you know, that's why Ambedkar is almost like the blue-eyed boy for everybody. And that's one of the concerns also for us, because what they could do is to misappropriate or only selectively misinterpret his cause, which is very radical, very anti-Brahminical, anti-caste. And, you know, he would not sit well with the people who want to hold on to the values and the context that put his people back to the square one, which is the lowest caste position. So that is very clear in his project. And for that, Ambedkar has methods. He has a step-by-step guide. And one is, of course, from his life. And second, he has written that by himself. And it is in this quest of finding Ambedkar as opposed to discovering Ambedkar, one really has missed out on many aspects. So we would like to, you know, and that's why I've tried to, and you know, in my next book, potentially, if I get good time to work on it, will be. I mean, I've signed a contract early this year on writing the biography of Ambedkar. That will be the first Dalit written English biography of Ambedkar.
Oh wow! Okay.
Yeah, sadly enough, it's quite late.
Yeah.
But someone had to do it. Yeah.
Wonderful. I have one last question, and then we can talk about what you, more things that you're doing next. You already gave us a kind of a sneak peek, but you kind of describe the middle class as undemocratic, right? And you delve into this discussion about the Dalit middle class. So how does that impact the status quo? And if you want to discuss, if you want to go into this, how is this related to politics today, right? How do the needs of the Dalit people need to be addressed politically?
I talked about the undemocratic nature of the middle class, especially that is fixated into the caste-based social order, which is hierarchical in nature. So if it's already hierarchical, then there is no democracy there. And the Indian middle class then is part of that, because Indian middle class is outcome of this Indian social order, which is Indian Brahminical order. And that's why when we appreciate the class aspect of Indian society, we have to look at it as already an undemocratic force which is working much in action and very much actually full time to retain the status. Now, within that, a very tiny minority yet, and I also write in that book, is there is quite a significant, influential class among Dalits that is emerging, or also, especially post neoliberalization process, where what we had a kind of a state-sponsored middle class, that's mostly a service-oriented class, which is basically in a very precarious position. They want their kids to go to Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard. Yet also they have immense responsibilities. So they try their best to negotiate these two responsibilities. But also many times they try to ascribe to the middle class values, which I say, that's never been your case. Mm-hmm. You cannot become a total Indian middle class, because Indian middle class has a caste order. And you will never get into that caste rank to be recognized as somebody. And so that is how I was trying to, I tried to argue in this paper, in this chapter, especially as to how the middle class sensibilities, I have a hope for they will contribute to the Dalit liberation. And that's why it kind of takes a critical take on the middle class politics. But also you can see, I talk about the Dalit middle class through the global experiences, right?
Right.
The American middle class, as well as and of course the Indian middle class has been the Indian middle class runs the country in its political electoral form, if you will, because it's one of the most influential. It votes, it influences the opinions, it controls the opinions. And so the middle class logic of India, and of course we don't know what middle class, there is no set definition, by the way.
Right.
The McKinsey talks one, the Indian government doesn't have a specific variation on who to identify middle class. And then there are various experts, mostly economic, fiscal economists who try to define. But middle class is, as it is said, it's a sensibility, is how you think also, it's a consciousness. And in that sense, I really hope the middle class wannabe will always remain wannabe if they don't challenge the status quo that they feel they will have one day opportunity to climb. That's the hope of capitalist order. It's more especially the neoliberal dichotomy that it wants to maintain the system, but at the same time it offers the hope, which is never going to be possible. I mean, you cannot become a Rockefeller. Or you cannot become a Carnegie Mellon by just sharing the stories of it. You really come from an order that is 24/7 invested in maintaining your caste status. So how are you still going to, aspire to that? So there has to be new innovations to how then you will define your own existence in your caste as well as class order. And maybe then there are options. So that's why in that nature, I refer to the undemocratic character of the Indian middle class, where I don't want Dalits to then enter into that undemocratic charter,
right,
and then become a more problem, a growing problem for the community also.
Right, absolutely. So you did mention that you're endeavoring to write the biography of Ambedkar. What else are you working on next? I know I know that you're working on such a wide, diverse range of things. Can you share some of that with our audience?
Sure. As I said, I signed the book contract And we are hoping one of the way the commissioning editor pitched me this idea of Ambedkar biography is to then get Netflix interested in this.
And wow.
So they can make a, so I am writing in that fashion. And Ambedkar is, my God, he is, it will take you, he is so complex. And another interesting thing is there is so much written on him that that it, even for me to go to his references, I had to limit myself to two books because there was just, still I had to refer to three books, even writing his early part of his life. And, I've written more or less 40% of the book now. Okay. But now his actual life starts, which is political life, 1920 onwards. And so now, he is writing his PhDs, he's giving memorandums, he's writing speeches, he's writing editorials, he's running movements. He's also being a lawyer, he's fighting cases of important values, he's fighting the case of, or in the case of prostitution or sexuality, he's also, fighting the cases. I mean, he's a lawyer, but also he's a father, he's a husband, and then he's helping establish new democratic framework for India by negotiating with the British that don't trust this dominant caste Brahmins and Baniyas, the Nehrus and Gandhis of Congress, because these people are the new colonizers for us, one master going, other coming. So there is so much, and he spent much of his time in London, the international deliberations. So that is one book that I am currently writing. The second book, which is under review right now, I'm writing with Professor Kevin Brown, a book on what we call caste and race remix, where we are trying to bring out the African-American connection with the Dalit. So far it was African-American connection with the Indian freedom movement, and Howard Thurman, Du Bois, Martin Luther King Jr., even Malcolm X, all were smitten by the Indian nationalist movement, because also it was India was the largest anti-colonial nation that was leading the battle on certain values and ethics. So we are now revisiting that through more specifically putting a primary lens on African American and Dalit part of that equation, the Dalit and the character of African American, we also have almost, that work is under progress. It's an academic work, as you know, it's a collaboration work. So, but we are happy. We are kind of trying to bring in that book some of the shortcomings and some of the deficiencies of some of the leadership's oversight over this important aspect of, it's also a way to correct some of the history, which was not informed to the African American public. But also, unsurprisingly, many African Americans knew about Ambedkar, knew about untouchable. In fact, not many. In fact, the concern was on untouchability. Even MLK, when he appreciated Gandhi, he appreciated Gandhi's image to wipe off untouchability. And he thought that because, of course, that was what was propagated in the newspaper. So we have so much of archive that we are going through old newspapers. And, that's, I've been doing that for the past 5 years now. And now it has come to this stage. The third book I'm working on, which I just started writing my, thinking about the lit review right now, is the Dalit Black Worlds. I'm thinking about five major thinkers, Du Bois, Ambedkar, Fanon, Martin Luther King, and Steve Biko in South Africa, to think about, how the Dalit and Black world thought, the intellectual cartography, is going to be framed, and how it is going to be helpful for our next generation. I want to, provide a guidance text for this international intersectional work that is only going to grow from now. So these are three books that are on my table, and simultaneously, I am, I'm hopefully going to edit a series with Oxford University Press. I'm hoping to get 10 Dalit scholars from South Asia published on their, amazing academic work, that would also take some time. So these are some very immediate projects on hand. Yeah,
that's a lot of immediate books.
I know you might. you might get it like, oh, wow, he just published one book last year and another one this year. No, the work is happening.
I know there's other things that you're working on, right? You mentioned regarding Dalit film literature that you're also mm-hmm. curating.
Mm-hmm. So as you might know, we curated the first Dalit Film Festival last year in New York. Massive success in 3 days. We pulled it off. And so now people are asking for the second installment. Because of COVID and other issues, you know, we just thought to wait. We wanted to do it once in 2 years, just because it takes, you know, so much logistics.
Right.
And it's surprising that so many entries we still get. We haven't even opened the call, but people keep sending, the new filmmakers keep sending their amazing work to us. And so that we hope to, you know, now we are looking for a location. We would like to make it more international and not one location. So a team from Vancouver, Ambedkarites, have, proposed their venue to organize a festival of such nature. And in the meanwhile, I am right now working on organizing International Dalit Literary Festival. And because, you know, the Dalit literature is a very vast, large canvas, which is written, there are so many local or rather regional languages, so rich in its content. And of that, the Dalit story is again enriching, that, these are the people whose amazing literature, actually, it really is a soul mirror for a humanity to meditate once you read one of these books by the Dalit authors. So I want to, I'm to organize a, you know, literary festival inviting poets, writers, columnists, people who scribe on the Dalit issues and give attention to Dalits who have never been appreciated for their, you know, internationally at least, for their yeoman service to literature. And for that, you know, we are still scouting the venue, and I'm hopeful that I get a venue. This time, you know, the people in London have expressed their interest in hosting this festival. So once that happens, you will surely know. And I invite you and also your listeners to come once that is finalized.
That sounds wonderful. Can't wait to see all of your new work. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today, Suraj. Again, my name is Preeti Ramaprasad. This is the New Books Network for South Asian Studies. And today we talked to Dr. Suraj Yengde and his book, Caste Matters. Thank you, everybody.